listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Musician Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 205 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin Bruner, and joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how are you?
I'm good. I've got a lot of really fun, exciting things going on musically, but the thing I thought I would mention to you today is, you know how we always say the one hater just ruins it all?
Yes.
So I'm preparing for this huge Peter Gabriel tribute show with like these great musicians. There's a guy from Lucinda Williams' band and a woman that plays with Elvi and Ila Bamba and a guy that plays with T-Pain. Like, it's a great band. I'm super psyched for it. And so I decided I would take out a Facebook ad for the show and target Peter Gabriel fans in the Portland, Oregon area. And, you know, people are registering their interest and some are buying tickets and all the things you'd hope would happen. And then I'm reading through the comments on the ad and one person says, "This sounds toe-curlingly awful." And the other person said, "Meh." And I'm just like, who goes out of their way to be negative like that? And then it reminded me that last week I was watching one of the videos of John Coltrane's Giant Steps on YouTube, and 210 people had disliked it. And I'm like, who the hell are these people that found like an undeniable jazz classic and then disliked it? Like, are you just discovering this for the first time and then you think you're somehow qualified to now give it a thumbs down?
Chris, it's not you. It's not you. People do these things because they're so dissatisfied with their life that the internet has provided them the perfect passive-aggressive outlet to go pour hate on others in hopes that they will feel better themselves. So it's not you.
I've never seen a sponsored ad in my Facebook feed of a band, listen to it, not liked it, and then gone and like said, eh. Or this, like, just leave it alone. Like, if you're not interested, just move on with your friggin' life.
Well, that's what normal people do. When they're not interested in something, they're not interested. They move on. But the internet has sparked something in many of us that we feel compelled to pour hate. And I'd use the collective we. I don't identify with those folks. I move on myself. I have no need to ruin someone's day, yeah, even if my day sucks.
And it works, though. It triggers all my insecurities. And
yep. So I'm just going to show up to that show with a t-shirt that just says, meh.
That's brilliant. You should.
That reminds me of one of my favorite scenes in Spinal Tap, where they're playing at the puppet show or opening for the puppet show, and someone's sitting in the audience. There's like five people. One guy's got just holding his thumb down. up. It's just so funny.
Spinal Tap. Oh, no, Puppet Show and Spinal Tap. Right.
I need to watch that movie again. I've pretty much lived almost every scene of that movie. And if you haven't watched Spinal Tap, you need to watch Spinal Tap. That's a rite of passage for any musician, especially if you've been out touring. You will laugh, you will cry, you might feel embarrassed at a few points, but it's something we all must go through.
Speaking of Spinal Tap, as I've been watching the behind the scenes videos of this Peter Gabriel, you know, that we're trying to recreate a specific concert that he did in the 90s. And so there's behind the scenes footage of him preparing for this tour. And he says that they had a tree made to be at the center of the stage. And he was expecting like a giant tree. And then when he saw what they'd actually made, he felt like it was the Stonehenge scene from Spinal Tap, because it was tiny compared to what he felt like he was commissioning.
And that's funny. So see, it happens to the best of them.
Yeah. So our tree, maybe we'll make our tree even smaller.
Well, I've been in that odd mixing point where you're mixing a record and nothing sounds good anymore. That, not that the songs are bad or the mixes are bad, but you've listened to something so many times that you just lose all perspective. So
just flip a coin.
Trying to wade through that's a couple things have come down to that. Trying to get through that and then hopefully have a new album out. But I think we're going to have a single out maybe next week. We'll see. I'm going to see if I can pull it together. The song is done. I just need to get some artwork together and get it out. So
take our own advice and don't rush.
Well, it wouldn't be rushing the single. It's the album that, because the single, I've got some art in process. If I can get it done, I will get it up Friday. Because I want this one to kind of be a surprise. And it's a collaboration with another singer from a different band. Some of you may have heard of them. They're called Third Day. They were from Atlanta, as was Small Town Poets. And we got our starts all around the same time. They got way more famous than us. And so a few years back, a couple of guys wrote a song with their lead singer, Mac Palin. So it's he sings on it, and it's a duet, and it's a really great song. And so hopefully it does well. I'm trying to do the collaboration thing, Chris. Collaborate with someone with a bigger audience.
You going to do the compound artist name?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just a feature.
Right. Okay.
So yeah, we got that going on. And not to mention, you and I think we invented a new genre today.
We did. What was it called? Inauthentic authenticity.
Authentically inauthentic. Yeah, right. No, authentically inauthentic.
It's not even a genre. That's like a blanket term for like so much music.
Yes, which is a sad state of affairs when it feels like, and it was because you and I were commenting, I was like, this sounds good, but it just feels like you said, authentically inauthentic.
There's no there there.
Yes. Be authentic, people. Before we get into the news, and then we've got sort of a short discussion section today, and then lots of calls and emails. You guys keep sending in great calls and emails. So this show's going to be mainly focused around that. But before we get into all that, it is CD Baby's 20th anniversary year. Woo-hoo. And we are having a big celebration. Tell the people what they can get, Chris.
Oh, you can get worldwide distribution and monetization for your music. Well, I'm really sounding like an advertisement there. at our original 1998 prices, which is $35 for standard distribution. And what are we doing with Pro? It's $20 off, right?
$20 off Pro submission. And all you have to do is head over to cdbaby.com and use the coupon codes 20 years or 20 years Pro. I think using 20 years Pro just sounds cooler. So I'm going to go with that option. But yeah, it's the 20th anniversary of CD Baby. And you and I are some of the old timers around here. You've been working here 12 and a half years. And I think next week is my 12th anniversary.
It's so bizarre to think of all the Jurassic phase and the Triassic phase of like working our way through this amazing and also strange at times company.
Yes, Chris and I could tell you stories. We won't ever speak of them on this podcast, but we could tell you stories. If you come out to one of our conferences and hang with Chris and I, you can hear some of those behind-the-scenes stories that have gone down in the lore of CD Baby. One final plug before we get to the heart of the show. The conferences are coming up, especially the Europe conference. Head on over to DIYMusicianCon.com to get tickets for our Nashville conference in August, or DIYMusicianCon.com/Europe to get tickets for our European conference, which is happening in Valencia, Spain. Ticket sales are picking up. We have a limited number of tickets for that. And it's going to be an amazing time. Going to be a little bit more low-key, more casual in Valencia. So Chris and I will just be hanging out, soaking up some sun.
Is that all we're doing? That's awesome.
I think the first half of the day, we're just taking everybody to the beach. I'm pretty sure that's what we have planned. And we'll just talk on the beach. And the second half of the day, we'll go on a bar crawl or something. I don't know. No, we've got some great stuff planned. It's at the Berklee College of Music there in Valencia, Spain. So if you're in Europe or other points and want to be in Europe, get tickets to that. We're only a little bit less than 2 months away. And boy, do I have a ton of work to do before we go to Spain. But it's official. Chris and I will be there. I bought his hotel room yesterday.
You did.
I had mine a while ago, but I just find I probably should get Chris a hotel room.
You also pretty much found my plane tickets as well. It's nice. You're like my travel agent for this trip.
Well, a little known fact about me, I actually really enjoy working out travel arrangements. I don't know why, but I like digging around, finding airline deals and hotel deals and making arrangements. So if this whole music gig never pans out, I got a future as a unemployed travel agent. So, all right. Well, I hope to see all of you at one of those conferences. If you have questions, feel free to email us at the podcast and we can answer them, or there's an email address at the conference website. But with all that said, let's get into the news.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
Music.
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 News.
We've got some big news items, at least one really big news item, and here it is. Songwriters have won a big victory. The royalty rate for interactive streams will rise by 44% over the next 5 years. Right now, streaming services pay about 10.5% of their revenue to songwriters for the usage of composition, copyrights, the rights to the underlying songs, as opposed to the specific master recordings of those songs. The Copyright Royalty Board has announced an exciting ruling for songwriters and publishers that payout rates must increase to 15.1% over the next 5 years. This is the largest rate increase in the history of the Copyright Royalty Board and means that songwriters would see a 44% boost in their revenue from on-demand streaming via services like Apple Music and Spotify. Here's how gradual rate increases will unfold. Streaming services in the U.S. must pay to songwriters and publishers 11.4% of revenue in 2018, 12.3% in 2019, 13.3% in 2020, 14.2% in 2021, and 15.1% by 2022. To be very clear, these are publishing royalties owed to the publisher or songwriter, generated from the usage of the underlying song, not the recorded track being streamed. As such, this money is accounted for and paid separately from the royalties you earn when your master recordings are streamed. You must have a publisher or publisher administrator to collect this money. That's why we have CD Baby Pro. So if you haven't upgraded your music to our pro publishing program, you'll be missing out on this money, and you're already missing out on that 10.5%. Well, Jack White definitely hates phones at his concert, so he's banning them. Some performers don't mind phones at their shows. Jack White definitely isn't one of them. Now, Jack is banning all mobile phone usage at his shows. Actually, White has been asking his fans to keep their phones in their pockets for years. It hasn't worked, so now he's trying a different approach. First, you can still bring your phone to the venue, but you'll be forced to seal the phone in a locked pouch. If you want to open the pouch, you have to leave the concert area. A locking pouch will be provided for people to hold their phones in during performances. Jack White has already been testing the idea, and he said people embrace the idea of ditching their phones. Quote, "We tried and people loved it." White recently told Conan O'Brien, "They applauded and everyone as a mob agreed. We don't like this idea, this practice of filming everything, because I think it's distracting for people in the back who really want to watch. They see this sea of blue screens in front of them, between them and the artist," end quote there. This isn't some cloth sack with a padlock around it. It's actually a specifically designed pouch designed by a company named Yonder. It actually remains locked within a certain predefined perimeter, usually the section around the stage. Head out to the lobby or outside and the lock releases. White loves the idea because it keeps fans more engaged, but he's not the only one. Last year, the Lumineers also tried out the concept. Others are road testing the idea, including Alicia Keys and Guns N' Roses. Spotify has officially introduced songwriter and producer credits. Producers, engineers, songwriters, and session players have all been hurt over the past two decades by a lack of digital liner notes and proper credit within the metadata that accompanies each song. Once upon a time, you'd hear a song you liked, find who tracked or mixed it, printed in the liner notes, and get in touch with that engineer to see if they could work on your next album. Strange that in the digital age, in which information is normally more accessible, accompanied the disappearance of proper credits. This means that many professionals in the music creation process now have to rely more on word of mouth, and it hurts their livelihoods. Spotify recently announced that Spotify users around the world can view songwriter and producer credits for tracks on the desktop platform. Simply right-click on a track and select Show Credits from the menu of options to view information on performers, songwriters, and producers. At launch, we're showing information we have from record label provided metadata, and we'll also display the source of the credits so you know where it's coming from. We realize some of the label provided credits are incomplete or may contain inaccuracies, but this is just the first step in displaying songwriter credits on Spotify. The feature will continually evolve to become more efficient, provide better functionality, and incorporate more information from industry partners over time. And that is the news. So some interesting developments that I think, the songwriter victory, that's good news, right, Chris?
That's great. And I was going to make it a segue back to CD Baby Pro, but you took care of that in the news report.
Yeah, to be very clear, because there's a lot of confusion, especially when it comes to streaming, that when your music is streamed at Spotify, they also owe a mechanical royalty. And that usually comes out to be, under the current pricing breakdown, it comes out to be typically an extra dollar for every $5 you make on Spotify. So if you made $5 on Spotify, if you were part of CD Baby Pro, you would have had an extra dollar. But that'll go up quite a bit with this. So it's probably going to be, I'd say it'd be another 50 cents. So if you're streaming, if you're making several hundred bucks a month off Spotify, that's real money that you need to tap into.
Yeah, I mean, and I know we say this a lot, but as streaming adoption continues to go up and up and up, not only is the percentage of that you're earning going up, but you'll earn more in volume as well. So
yeah, so it's something that's a big victory. It's something that'll roll out over that 5-year time period. And as I mentioned in the article, it's a percentage of revenue. So it's all of Spotify's revenue combined. So that's why when you hear people talk about streaming rates and stuff, it's really hard to say you're going to get exactly this, because it's not like a download where someone pays 99 cents for a download. You're going to get a certain amount. This depends on how much revenue they have and how they split it out. So it's good news. And, this is what people have been asking for, and it's starting to happen. What are your thoughts about the whole phone thing with Jack White, Chris?
Oh man. I'm very torn. Like, part of me thinks it's awesome, and then the purest part of me thinks it's awesome. Then there's this other part that's just like, it's so unrealistic. I mean, people have come to, I feel like, think of a concert experience as a social and somewhat online experience. Even when they're there in person, like, they want to take their phone out, capture a little bit of it, prove they were there, share it on Instagram or whatever. Like, that's, I just feel like that's such an ingrained part of concert culture now, like, that it seems a little bit fascist in a way to make everyone lock up their phones. I get the impulse. But the other thing that made me laugh is, like, on the one hand, when he was asking his fans to do it, they weren't. Then when he forced them, he basically said, oh, they loved it, and they were cheering like a mob. Like, well, which was it? Like, it's probably some of them love it and some of them don't, and you're just hearing from the ones that...
I like how he described his fans as a mob.
I didn't mean it that way. He described it that way.
Yeah, right. He did.
Yeah. But I don't know. What do you think about it?
I've been on the record on this podcast many episodes. It's been a while since this has come up, because I know, like, Prince made a big deal about it and a while back, and we talked about it then, and I don't know if we've talked about it much since then. I get where he's coming from. Actually, he made a point that is the first time I've been like, okay, I get it. I'm only 5'9". I understand when I'm standing on the floor, like, 3/4 of the way back, and everyone in the room seems to be like 6'2". That's usually how it feels at a concert. And then they hold their phones up above their head. It really makes it a challenge to see what's going on. I don't have a problem with people filming, but it does make it a challenge to see what's going on. So that was an interesting point, but I just see someone like standing there really struggling with the idea of letting go of their phone and just deciding to leave the concert because they just can't deal with not having their phone.
Yeah, well, like, at something like a house concert, there's a bit of, like, a self-policing behavior, I think, amongst the audience. Like, they know it needs to be a respectful environment. They know they're there to, experience something in the kind of old-fashioned analog way. So if someone takes a picture at a house concert, like, they're, like, slowly taking the phone out, they take a quick shot and they put it away, and then that's it. It's not... And it's, I guess, it would be nice if you could expect something similar at a large concert. And I think, didn't the Lumineers do something where they said, like, we don't really want you on your phones, but, like, during this song, like, this is the song where you should shoot stuff. So, like, it kind of became like a collective thing where everyone was in on it. And then after that, the expectation was, like, you put it away again.
Yeah, they did something. I think it was the Lumineers. I don't remember exactly how they approached it. And I think they may have even tested these bags. But so basically how this bag works is you go through some security checkpoint or something. Are they shaking people down for their phones? I mean, like, are people slipping their phones in their boot? I mean, it's but you go through some checkpoint and you get some sort of, you know, like sign in or whatever, so they know it's you, and you get this bag, you've put your phone in. So you hold on to the bag, and when you're in that zone, where, like, you know, it said maybe near the front of the stage or the whole concert hall, the bag's locked, and then you have to leave that zone for the bag to unlock. It seems pretty expensive to try and pull that off and keep that on the road with you.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, to be honest, it's been a long time since I've gone to, like, a huge, huge show at, like, a, you know, an enormous arena or something. And is it really such a problem where people are having their phones up, like, the whole time? I don't even have the memory on my phone to do that. I'm like, okay, I'll take 20 seconds, and now that's it for the next 2 hours, and now I can pay attention to the show again.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten to the point when I go to a show, I might take one or two quick pictures. I've given up on video because I think, what am I going to use this for? And the answer is nothing. And right. even posting that stuff on, like, Instagram or something, a lot of times it's so distorted sounding that it's like, why does anyone want to hear this? I like a nice, clean, well-crafted photo over a crappy video. So I don't know. The whole reason I bring it up is because I think it'd be interesting to hear from all of you listening to this podcast what you think, and to weigh in with your opinions on phones at your shows, both as the artist and when you attend shows. So if you wanted to call in our listener line at 360-524-2209, or just leave a comment in the show notes, it might be a good one for the commenting in the show notes section so everyone could see comments and, you know, weigh in with their opinions. But I think, so that's one. I was curious what other artists think and if artists are doing anything at their shows. But two, the other thing, reason I bring it up is because, you know, Jack White can get away with something like this. I think if you're an artist that's an independent artist, or, you know, you kind of get to a certain level, a pretty big level, before you can start demanding things of your audience that put them out, maybe make them uncomfortable, that doesn't go bad for you. Like, I never like it when an artist is put in the position of policing their crowd or their fans, or insisting that you do it this way, because your fans have bought tickets. You don't know what's going on in their life. You don't know who a lot of them are, and they show up and they want to experience an event because they paid for it, and you're that event. And then putting all these parameters on it, to me, just like, forget this. I'll just go somewhere else where people aren't hassling me.
Yeah, I mean, you said it, like, there's a bit of it, like, if it's a commandment instead of an invitation, or even, like, I think what I would much prefer is for the performer to create these moments and this concert experience that's worth, like, just being present for. And, I mean, I don't know, now that I say that, though, I think that people can still be present and take a bunch of pictures. Like, they're just treating it slightly different than people did like 30 years ago. But
it is amazing how many people go to a show, though, that you see and they've actually have good seats and they sit there with their face in their phone the whole time. And that, to me, is a different thing, because it's like, that's not them distracting others, but that's just them paying a lot of money and not being present. And I think Jack might be feeling that too. I mean, as an artist, if you are on stage and everyone in the front is uninterested down on their phone, it's like, why did you come to the show?
Oh, you know, I didn't even, this whole time we've been talking about it, I didn't think of it from that angle. I thought it was, you know, people using their phones to capture something from the show, but then inconveniencing others because of that. I didn't even think about, like, their phone just constantly buzzing because they're getting tweets or whatever, and they're, Yeah, all right, be fascist. Take everyone's phones away.
Well, for those of you that were at the DIY Musician Conference in Nashville last year and happened to go to the showcase we had at the Cannery Ballroom, there was a hysterical event that happened. I think I mentioned this on the podcast before. This band, Hillbilly Casino, that was their name, right?
Yeah.
Hillbilly, yeah. Amazing live performance. I mean, these guys, my jaw hit the ground. I did not know what I was going to see. I just heard that they were great live, and it was unbelievable. It was a case study in how to put together an amazing show. And they get to this one point where they had props, they had all this stuff. They get to this one point, he's got this very high-powered flashlight, like the kind like you have in a case of emergency. It's like a big handle and a giant bulb. You know, it looks more like a weird space gun than it does a flashlight. And he's using it, just flinging it around the room. And he noticed that this person who's on the front barricade, that, you know, between the stage and the barricade, they're leaning on it. They're just totally on their phone, not paying attention to anything. And he just put the spotlight on her. And everyone in the venue is looking at her and cracking up. She has no idea that the spotlight's on her and that everyone's looking at her.
Like,
and she's
for
missing this.
Seconds.
Yeah, it was. I was trying as fast as I could to get my phone out so I could take a picture, because I was standing backstage and had the perfect shot right down the barricade of him pointing that at her, and I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it done. But so I get the idea that if you're a performer and all the people in the front of the stage are acting uninterested, it really kills a lot of the energy of the show, especially when you're at bigger venues, because having played some arenas and such over the years, those stages, you already feel very disconnected from the audience, because there's usually like a big gap between the audience and they're just so far away. And then if everyone's just on their phones, it just feels like, why am I here?
Yeah. I'm glad you reminded me of that, though.
So I'd be curious to see what other people think. I've been to multiple shows recently where the artist was like playing right to the person and they had no idea. Not just the spotlight one where that was the whole audience was ridiculing somebody. This was like the artist is like right in front of them singing to them and they have no idea. And they're like, but they're busy tweeting that they're at the show. And they missed this moment that they could have had with the artist themselves. It's funny. Anyway, the last news item, which we're going to sort of morph into a mini discussion point for today's episode before we get into all the listener calls and emails. And that was Spotify now displaying songwriter credits. So if you go to Spotify, you have to do it on the desktop and you right click, just like we said in the news section, there is a thing that says, I forget what the exact word it says.
Show credits, I think.
Yes, that's what it is. And it'll say songwriters, the artist, and producer. Now, for most people, the producer space is empty, even major label artists. I've looked at a bunch, and a lot of major label artists, that's still empty because Spotify has not been asking for that information. And so there's a few instances where I saw it. But so if your music's been distributed by CD Baby, your songwriter credits should be there. So that's important. It's a good step towards where we need to be. But really what I wanted to take a minute and discuss is all the things that you need to be keeping track of. We've gotten a little lazy in the digital space because we haven't been attaching this information with our releases, but we need to, you know, get back to keeping track of all this stuff, because in the very near future, it's not only going to have production credits, it'll have, you know, pretty much full album credits that you typically would see in a CD release. So I would say we're probably still 2-3 years out from feeling like there's more robust crediting happening. But if you want that information out there, you got to keep track of it.
It's also pretty common, like, you know, you get 5-10 years away from the making of an album and suddenly, like, you're like, okay, who was that guy that came in for 15 minutes to play like 3 notes on the tuba? And I forgot that there was actually 7 background vocalists. I only credited 4 of them. Like, so it's better to just make these kind of detailed notes right away. Make sure you save them. for everything, for the arranger, the session players, the mixing engineer, the mastering engineer. What else? All sorts of
session
stuff.
Players, arrangers, cover art design,
right? Yeah, all that kind of
studio
stuff.
I think, you know, getting everybody who is working on it. Sometimes it's easy to think of the producer and the main engineer, but there may be other engineers. And also the studio location. I was told by somebody that if you actually recorded in the UK, even though you're like an American artist or from other places, that it might unleash some extra neighboring rights for you for that song in the UK, because you actually recorded there. So it's just keeping track of everything. And this reminds me, we had a horn section on come in and play on our record we're finishing up, and I'm assuming somebody has their names.
We'll get them now. Well, the other thing, yeah. I didn't put this in the article I wrote about on this topic recently, but I've mentioned it in the past, that even though right now you can't provide all that stuff in the metadata, you can put it on your notes on CD Baby for the release. You can put it on Bandcamp. You can put it on SoundCloud. You know, anywhere where you can edit the notes that accompany a song, you should put all that stuff, because you know, someone might be curious. And when they are, you're doing a favor for all your collaborators, and you know, potentially helping them drum up some business.
Yeah, and there's some strategic reasons why I think this is going to be very cool in the future. So if you're sitting there thinking, this just sounds like work, nobody cares, I don't care if my profile doesn't have extended album notes. And one, the people that are contributing to your record do. It's kind of a, you know, it's the professional thing to do, to credit the people that helped make the record. But beyond that, one of the companies that's helping to solve the metadata issue, I was having a meeting with them, and they were, you know, talking about a future where all these different points could be different playlist opportunities, could be different ways fans get into the music. So for example, right now I can't go on Spotify and look at every record that Slash has played on, or Eddie Van Halen. Those guys have played on some pretty big pop records. And if you're a fan of, you know, those artists, it'd be really cool to see all the different albums they've played on. Plus, there's some really big names in the studio world that it'd be really cool to, you know, sort of give them some light, shine a light on them a bit, and be able to like follow a rabbit trail of, like, there's a guitar player that he produces a lot of records now. His name, Dan Huff. When I was in Nashville, he played on pretty much every country and Christian record in Nashville. He ended up producing people like Megadeth and a whole bunch of country artists that have had huge hits. And he's an amazing guitar player, but he's doesn't do solo records, but he's played on everybody's records. He's played on Michael Jackson's records. He's played on everybody's records. And it's like, it'd be really cool to make those connections. So that's what will happen in the future, and why strategically it makes sense for you as an artist to be invested in this data, not only to properly credit people, but that, you know, if you've got an engineer of note that worked on your record, or a producer, or one of them goes on to be famous, that's a really cool way for people to find your music and want to dig into all the records that, you know, someone's produced. I've done that with Daniel Lanois, and that's one of those things where I wish I could find more records that I know he's produced, because it's hard to find them these days. And it's a really cool way to think about all the places, even just the studio you used. People might want to hear all the records recorded in this cool studio. And those are ways to do
it. Artists, most of all. Like, I mean, you're thinking about where to record your next album. That's an obvious thing. Like, you want to kind of follow the trail of the person you're considering hiring. And, you know, my friend Jeff, he's worked on both of our records before. He mixed the recent Typhoon record, which, you know, went to number one on some chart or other and is getting lots of playlist placements and stuff. And, you know, it's just like, what kind of potential business is he missing out on? Because it just doesn't have a simple thing of mixed by Jeff Stewart Saltzman. Like, As this, you know, as this record he was kind of integral in working on is just taking off.
Yeah. And what, how cool would it be if somebody created a playlist of all the records he's worked on and gets a bunch of their fans listening to your music?
Yeah. Well, we'll just have to take that upon ourselves for now. If Spotify won't do it, we will.
But that's where things are headed. So it's one of those things you just need to keep in mind and keep track, come up with a system of taking good notes, because, you know, there's always that moment in the past where everyone was absolutely making CDs where you got to the artwork's done and then you're like, or you're going to the artwork and maybe the artist is working on it and everyone's like, ah, crap. And there's that band meeting to sit around and figure out who played on everything and who gets what and how are things credited and all that. So just something I wanted to talk a little bit more about because it's important and it's something that lots of cool things are going to be happening with that I think are going to be beneficial to everybody. And as you said, you made the best point out of all of it, Chris. You can go ahead and put this information on your CD Baby page, your Bandcamp page, and on SoundCloud. And all those pages are searchable. So if someone is searching by a famous engineer or producer that you used or session player, that's a good way to start trying to tap into a little bit of that.
Yeah. And just to make one more grumpy point, this information, it's not like in terms of all the data that gets delivered to these digital platforms, it costs nothing. I mean, almost nothing in terms of just information to have a few extra letters accompanying your track, you know, like that's yeah. My way of saying, I don't know why this didn't become common practice like 20 years ago or whenever, you know, digital music started taking off.
From what I've heard, Steve Jobs did not want all the clutter. And because iTunes basically defined the market, there you have it. Hmm.
Well, I'll keep my mouth shut then.
No, you can speak up. No one's going
to
stop you.
Just be a little question and they can expand a box to see the credit. It's not like it has to be, you know, shouting at you this information, but it should have just been accessible.
Yeah. I know. Exactly. All right. Well, let's move on to our listener calls and emails, because I know you've got a hard stop or we've got to wrap up on the quicker side. And we're already running longer than we thought because we just like talking to each
That's
other.
That's what happens when we live on opposite coasts.
Yes. All right. So let's get into some listener emails and calls. All right. Let's start with an email. Hey, Kevin and Chris, it's Tobias from Berlin again, singer-songwriter Trailhead at trailheadmusic.com. I'm running a crowdfunding campaign for my upcoming album of walking songs right now. To promote it, I'm posting different news items on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at least daily, sometimes several times daily. I'm trying to find balance between letting people know about the campaign often enough to really reach them and get them to take action and try not to annoy them with the many posts and more frequent emails. Those are not daily. Especially concerning Facebook. What's your advice here? Posting multiple times a day as each post is only shown to a limited amount of friends and followers? And what's your take on using the band site versus personal profile? I get the impression that posts on the band site don't get any attention unless one pays for boosting the reach. On the personal page, on the other hand, one runs the risk of alienating friends with too many music business posts. What's the point of a band page on Facebook these days? I hope this makes sense. Best wishes from Berlin. And as always, thanks for the great work, Tobias. All right. This is all you, Chris. You got the answer for that.
Oh, well. No, what I don't have the answer. But what I would say is I'm actually really struggling with this myself. And I've made a point of trying to read a bunch and try to kind of reinvest in Facebook in a way. You know, I'm not saying I'm doing a stellar job, but I'm paying more attention to Facebook and I want to get to the bottom of whether it's worth me continuing to, you know, put all the eggs in a band page basket, or if I should really just say, you know, I'm a singer songwriter with my own name. I'm going to be okay with just my personal thing. I'm asking the same question. I think that if your intention is to grow your career to the extent that, you know, you're going to have more than 5,000 fans, then I think it's worth going and paying the money to boost your posts on your page and grow your page audience. And, you know, Facebook is an amazing advertising platform where you can do incredible targeting and all that. And I know it sucks to have to pay to get reach, but it is a powerful tool still. You know, it's an extremely powerful tool. So maybe it's worth focusing on your page. If you are more of like, you know, I'm a local singer-songwriter, I'm never going to tour, I'm okay with making a living that isn't based on reaching the entire world, it might make more sense for you to just say, okay, forget the page. I'm just going to work on my own profile and, you know, reach my friends or whatever. I think that's a very indecisive answer, but.
Well, they have made it harder and harder and harder for pages to reach anybody. And there are certain things, parameters that they want to see, like shares and likes, but not everything is deserving of a share or like. I mean, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, like every piece of content that isn't necessarily my response, you know, or comments. They want to see a lot of comments. It's like, not everything needs a comment.
Right.
But to answer your question about posting for a fan funding campaign, you know, I think daily on is fine. You just got to get creative. And that's the hard thing. It's like, you got to keep making the message interesting. And that's the challenge I have found with the fan funded campaigns I've done in the past. Chris, did you have thoughts on that portion of his question?
Well, I can actually speak directly to him on this because I follow him on Facebook, and I can say I have not.
You're like, stop posting so much.
No, the opposite. I was going to say I have not. I've noticed his posts. I've watched some of the videos. Like, I've engaged with some of it, and I've never felt assaulted by any of it. So, you know, I don't know if it, maybe I'm just seeing some of it, and I don't think I would feel any different though. It's like, you know, if I'm interested in the person or their music, it's not like I don't take it personally when they have some objective and they're asking for help. Like, as long as it's for 30 or 60 days, like if you were going on for 3 years every single day asking for pledges, yeah, that'd be ridiculous. But I think people understand, like, you're in the middle of something that's important to you and, you know, hopefully to them to some extent. So I don't even think of it as being forgiving, I guess. I think they're.
Yeah.
Accommodating. So anyways, I have not felt bombarded by his posts.
Okay. Excellent. I hope that helps, Tobias, and hopefully we'll see you in Europe. Let's jump to a call, because this is a call I forgot to include on our last episode, and it deals with Facebook and a Facebook workaround, and I thought it was pretty cool.
Hi guys, this is Francesca Ani from Tampa, Florida. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I just wanted to comment about the Facebook message from last episode. So to circumvent the whole Facebook taking down your videos, what I've started doing is posting 20 to 30 seconds of each cover video that I do, and then posting the full cover video on YouTube. So it's more like a preview to the full cover video, but you're still putting a native video on Facebook, so that way it's still really high ranking in the Facebook algorithm. And then what I do is I put the link to the YouTube video in the comments, because if you put the link in the post itself, then that like lowers the Facebook post in their algorithm. So yeah, just thought I would share and let you know about some ways to help make your videos better seen and not taken down. All right. Thank you guys. Love your talk. And yeah, thank you.
So I think that was a really good idea. She's talking about ways of getting cover song videos on Facebook seen, but not taken down, but then also just posting the snippets of them. So they get shared, but then she puts a link to the YouTube video in the comments. So if you want to see the whole song or the whole video, you go to YouTube. I think that's a wise bit of advice.
And I like that tip of the putting the link in the comments, because it does pull down, like, your video. If you post a link to YouTube on Facebook, YouTube doesn't, or Facebook doesn't like showing that post to people. They like showing videos that are posted directly to Facebook natively on the Facebook app. So putting the YouTube link in the comments won't inhibit the original post, but it will be there for people to click on. And it still will like show the video preview in the comments. You know, it'll pull in the video.
Yeah, I mean, this might be completely obvious, but one thing that fascinates me is how Facebook has become so successful because it's fooled people into either ignoring or not noticing the fact that it's an advertising platform. So they try to do whatever they can to minimize the sense that you're being pitched to or advertised to in some way. So even down to giving a lower rank to posts that have links in them, because that right there just looks like it's something, oh God, I have to do something with this post. And they think it's going to remind their users that someone wants something out of them. So the more like covert and sneaky you can be on Facebook, the better. And obviously putting a link in the comments as opposed to the post is a simple way to do that.
Thanks for that call. That was a good tip. All right, let's jump back to email. I've got one here. It says, I learn a ton every time I listen to the podcast. Concerning number 204, I'm wondering if you can walk me through how the folks that manage all of Oasis and the Gallagher brothers use Show.co to conduct contests. Did they build a separate contest landing page? How did they get the entry data for the Spotify follows? Do the Spotify follows end up yielding an email too? If not, then how did they notify winners? Can you please walk me through the basic process they used? So they just used the Show.co platform. They used, you know, it creates a landing page for you where the call to action is. And in the case of that, yes, it was followed on Spotify or putting your email address. And yes, it's a little secret, but when you use Show.co for people to follow you on Spotify, you get their email address. So they have all the email addresses from everybody, whether they followed on Spotify or they just put in their email address. Then they randomly selected a winner. I think even using Microsoft Excel, you can, you know, dump all the names in and do a random number generator thing and it'll select a random person. And that's how they do it.
Yeah. And on a campaign like that, you can export a CSV file. And it'll contain both the people who submitted their email addresses as well as the email addresses of the Spotify followers all in one.
Yep. And so it's really easy to do. That's why a lot of the major label managers and major label marketing folks have been using it, because it creates a landing page real quick and easy. You're not sitting there messing around with trying to design something and bog down in all that process. It's like you can have your campaign live in minutes and be ready to go. And it's optimized for conversion and for you to, you know, get your fans to do a specific thing. So that's been a popular one.
And in terms of like building anything with the Oasis campaign, the only thing they actually needed besides just a Show.co account was a picture of, a box set, right?
They've done lots of contests, but yeah, the box set was one that comes to mind.
So that's the only thing they need. They need a picture of whatever it is they're giving away or that speaks to the contest in some way. And then the rest of the campaign they can create in a matter of 2 minutes.
Yep. So I hope that helps, Denise. Thanks for your email. We'll finish up with one more email, then we'll knock out the rest of the calls. Here we go. Forgive me, I don't remember what recent podcast you mentioned this, but in passing, you mentioned that there's a general list of things that YouTube says a channel owner can do to easily get subscriber numbers in the 2,000 to 5,000 subscribers. I said pretty easily. That's what he quoted me. I immediately scoured YouTube and didn't find any such instructional video or any such PDF checklist. Do you have any more information on the suggestions from YouTube? Dude, love the podcast. Thanks so much for that, Mike. Yes, Mike. What YouTube puts out is called their Creator Playbook. And it outlines how to basically optimize your channel, and not only optimize your channel, but how they intended the platform to be used. There's also another great resource that we have that's probably more detailed, and actually I would recommend you start here. If you go to diymusician.cdbaby.com, it's our blog. If you click on the YouTube link right at the top of the page, you will go to all our YouTube articles, and there's a lot of great articles there that walk you through a lot of this. But the key is that you don't just need to optimize your channel, but you need to put content out in the manner that they recommend as well. And that's one key that a lot of artists miss. Chris, you were going to say something.
Well, first I was going to say, I too was confused by your comment at that, on that episode, because I wrote you after it was over and I said, what like resource were you talking about? And you said, oh, the creator, what's it called again? The creator manual or whatever.
Playbook.
Yeah. And I said, oh yeah. Okay. I know about that. I did get the sense you're talking about something else. So I was confused. He wasn't alone.
The keys that they do in the creator playbook are frequency of post, letting your followers know when you're going to be posting, using things like end cards. You got to have good content that people want to see, but the frequency of posting and the like specific days, and you know, there's some great things I've seen channels do, just encouraging people to subscribe. And using some graphics to do that, using the end cards to get people to watch more videos and also subscribe. If you have good content and you do those things, it's probably, I would say it's pretty easy to get to 2,000 to 5,000 subscribers, because what starts happening, and again, you got to have good content that people want to see that works for the YouTube platform. When you start doing those things the way YouTube wants, just like we talk about Spotify, they start featuring you in other people's feeds, in, you know, like when I open up YouTube, it gives me a bunch of recommended videos. Some are from channels I subscribe to. Most of them are not. They're from content they think I'll like. So that's the ticket with YouTube. You got to use the platform like they want.
Yeah. And I think probably 95% of musicians just treat YouTube as a place to park their music videos. And so that means, you know, you might have two or three or four videos you upload a year, but that's way, way less than what YouTube, you know, deems to be worthy of, like,
yeah,
saying.
You got to use the platform like they want it to be used. They want it to be used like you are doing a show. And so for an artist, like cover song videos that you can crank out a lot of, those work great. Even just some acoustic videos, but even you got to think about other content that you might do as well. But frequency is really important. If you're just going to do, you know, park a live concert video that's an hour and a half long, and that's all you do and wonder why you can't get to those subscriber thresholds, it's because that's not the kind of content that works on the platform. Things that are like, you know, 2 to 10 minutes, you know, depending on the kind of content, maybe 30, you know, there's some shows I watch that are longer than that, but, you know, they have it really dialed in. Those are the kind of things that people are having success with. And also like, the frequency is important.
Like how to build and perform on a Furby organ.
Exactly.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, Google it.
I'm going to have to do that right after the show, because I have no idea what you're talking about. So Mike, I hope that helps. Check out those resources on the blog, and anyone else who's listening that's curious, there's a lot of stuff in there, but it's going to require you to make videos, because if you want subscribers, you got to use the platform properly and you got to make videos. All right, we've got three more calls. This one is about arrangements.
Kevin and Chris, hey, it's Jim Jesse with Rock and Roll Law. Thanks for the shout out a couple of podcasts ago. Trying to answer the question that was asked then, the woman asked about rights and responsibilities regarding performance and recording of a public domain song or traditional song and arrangements. I'll answer it as briefly as I can. First of all, as far as performances are concerned, whether the song's in the public domain or not, generally the venue pays the license for that, so you can sing whatever you want live. You can record whatever you want live, too. You can record whatever song you want. When you reproduce it, that's when mechanicals and getting a license may pop in. First of all, if the song's in the public domain, no one owns it. So you can do whatever you want with it. You can arrange it however you want. Now, obviously, if you change lyrics, you would own the new lyrics, or change part of the melody, you would own that particular section. As far as arrangements are concerned, I mean, people seem to be hung up on arrangements and getting credit for writing the song. Here's the deal. Two copyrights in every song. It's the music and the lyrics. That's the composition side. And then there's the sound recording, generally referred to as the master side. The arrangement is going to be part of the production, and that is clearly on the sound recording or master side, okay? You do not own any of the music and lyrics because you did not write the music and the lyrics. I don't care how clever your arrangement is, okay? So, and again, that's significant. You're owning half the song. So that's where your ownership comes into play, is on the arrangement side. So again, I think most musicians aren't as keen or don't know as much about the sound recording side, so they forget about that. That's where the arrangement would come into play and on that particular side. Now, look, if someone takes your sound recording from the master and uses it without your permission, then, you know, they would need to get a license from you, and if they take it without your permission, that could be infringement. Now, if they use the same arrangement or a similar one but re-record it, then you're probably out of luck on that one. So again, you would own that sound recording if you do an arrangement, not the music and or lyrics. So hope that helps. Let's talk in person sometimes, or at least over the phone. And I'm planning on coming to the DIY conference in Nashville. I've already registered, so looking forward to it. Thanks. Take care and keep rocking.
All right. Well, I hope that helps. I think Jim was calling in response to the call we had a couple episodes back about somebody, an artist had an arrangement, was working with a music supervisor, and they basically stole his arrangement and recorded their own similar arrangement and used that version instead. So it looks like there's not much you can do about that.
Yeah, I think I said during that episode, and I'm just reminded of it, that if you arrange a public domain song or even a cover song so uniquely that you're afraid someone's going to steal it, it might be worth just taking those ideas and writing your own song from those elements. If your primary concern is being ripped off, if you think what you add to the cover song is what could also propel that cover song to get a bunch of attention, then it's probably worth sacrificing some potential, you know, what you deem to be infringement, even though I guess legally it's not.
Yeah, I agree. If you are writing a song that is so unique that it no longer resembles the public domain song you're working on, just write your own song off of it. because the public domain song, it's like, even if you borrowed some of the melodies, it's not going to matter because it's public domain. You can use those melodies. So, you know, that's something to consider. All right. We've got another call. This one deals with copyright.
Hey, Kevin. This is Andrew Herman Middleton calling from New Hagiography, newhagiography.com. Thanks so much for all you guys do. Love the podcast. Love the blog. Love the conference. I was there last year. I'm coming again this year. Got my ticket. I had a question about copyright, kind of a two parts to the question. And I guess you could refer to it as like elasticity of copyright is the kind of the question. So say I send a CD with 100 songs to the Copyright Office, acoustic versions, some basic lyrics, chord structure, melody, and so on. And then I send those in, but then I take like the seed of those songs, and I change them. So I put different lyrics. Say the chord structure is more or less the same, the melody is more or less the same, but maybe I add a bridge or whatever, and I change the lyrics. And then I put a demo out, say I record a demo and put it on YouTube. Is that demo protected by the song that I sent in along with those other songs on that CD? So it's not exactly the same, but if you looked closely, like the chord structure would be the same, the melody would be the same. Is that enough to provide copyright protection? Kind of second question relatedly, if I send in a CD with, say, 100 songs, say I'm going to put out 10 albums of music, and each album is going to have 10 songs. So I send in 100 songs to the Copyright Office. This time the lyrics, chord structure, melody, bridge, everything is the same. It's just acoustic version. And then I come out with like a full album version. When I come out with the album version, do I need to resubmit the final? Obviously, there'd be album art and stuff, so maybe that I'd want to submit for that reason. But say I don't care, and I just want the songs to be protected. Would the songs be protected? That's the question. Thanks so much for all you do. Take care. Bye.
Chris, do you want to take this one, or do you want me to take it?
You should probably take it, because I actually had a hard time hearing the beginning of his comment. So if I understood it, he has some songs that he did copyright, and then he changed them slightly, and he wants to know if the changed version is still protected.
Yeah, I mean, I think basically, if I could possibly simplify the question a bit, I think he's sort of asking when should he copyright his songs. I would say that if you've written in some songs and, you know, they're just demos you've got recorded on your hard drive, I wouldn't worry about copywriting them at that point. I mean, they are copywritten when you create them, but I wouldn't worry about filing your copyright with the U.S. government or whatever government agency in other countries deals with that. Until you're ready to release music, because if you're still working on them and things are going to change, you know, maybe Jim will call back in, or we can ask Joel, our in-house counsel. But my assumption would be that if you have a song and then you go rewrite the lyrics, that's a different song. And so it's probably not copywritten anymore. It needs to be its own copyright because it's got new lyrics. So my suggestion would be that when you're actually recorded the music and it's being released to copyright it, then before that point, it probably is jumping the gun a bit. And then once you have the song copywritten, you don't need to keep copywriting it every time you release it on a different collection. Like if it's on an EP, but then you include it on an album, you don't need to copyright it again. However, it can be easier, depending on your situation as far as the number of songs and all that, to just copyright the album as a whole. That's an option as well. But I'd recommend, we did an interview with Jim Jesse, who just called in a few minutes ago. We did an interview with him, I don't know, it's probably about 10 or 15 episodes back at this point. And he talks about some of that in detail. So you might want to check out that episode again. But you should simplify it and just, you know, when you're releasing it to the public, whatever that is that you're releasing, that's what you should copyright. All right, we've got one last call, and let's get to it now.
Hi, Chris and Kevin. This is the House Ninja. I produce dance music for heroes, and I have my first single released on CD Baby this fall. I've got another one scheduled for February 14th. I absolutely love your podcast and listen every time there's a new post. I especially like the show.co one you guys just did. It really gave me some actionable ideas. So here's my question. I signed up for the CD Baby conference in Nashville this summer, and this is my first time attending. So do you have any tips or tricks for somebody to take full advantage of the conference? Thanks again. You can find me at houseninjamusic.com or on Twitter and Instagram at houseninjamusic. Thanks, guys. Keep it up.
All right.
I have two tips. One would be that in advance of the conference, the earlier you get your tickets, which sounds like you've already taken care of that, we'll send out emails and notifications about different kinds of opportunities that might arise. Last year, that was like YouTube's pop-up studio in Nashville, Bob Boylan's song pitch session, some of our showcases, things like that. So the more look on the lookout you are for that stuff, the better. And I would say apply to all of it. Do as much as you can of that kind of stuff. And then the other thing I would have is go with somewhat of a, I don't know if an agenda is the right, go knowing what you want to get out of it. Kind of come up with where you think you need to work, and then kind of shape your curriculum and the people you try to meet and stuff all around that. And then to contradict myself, make sure you're just open to meeting whoever, because it's pretty friendly communal environment too.
Yeah, I'd say that's good advice. I think having a plan of what you want to target or work on maybe for the coming year, going in and knowing how you're going to plan your session attendance. I think a lot of people get there and feel overwhelmed. There's so many people, there's, you know, lots of interesting things going on at the same time. And if you don't have an idea of some of the key things you want to hear, you can end up just bouncing around and feeling like you didn't accomplish anything. But definitely that was a good tip that Chris had, getting your ticket early, because we do have things that, you know, we send out invites for artists to apply for, to be, you know, whether it's the guinea pig in the studio like we did last year, or the pop-up studio opportunities with YouTube, or the open mic, or some other things like the song pitching session. I, that's the artist's name. It's spelled A-H-I, but it's pronounced I. He got on the song pitching session and from there got featured on All Songs Considered. And I believe has done a Tiny Desk concert series. And it was all just because he pitched that song at our conference.
He was also on top of things early. Like I was saying, he did all of those things. He got the YouTube, he got in on the YouTube session early. He played a showcase. So he was just eager and paying attention and got a ton out of the conference.
And come planning to meet people. You know, there's lots of people there. The one thing that's always been a surprise for the conference, once we started it, you know, I've been to lots of conferences, and this one definitely feels like a community vibe, more so than any other conference I attend. And so, you know, be ready to meet some people and not be afraid to talk to folks. You know, we've had stories of people just randomly asking people to go to dinner and hang out and learn from each other. And it's a really cool environment for that. So plan ahead, and also get your hotel situation locked in, because you don't want to be trying to find a hotel in Nashville like the week before. It is a very busy time in Nashville as a whole. The city has very limited hotel space, and that weekend will be a packed house. So take care of all that. And, you know, and yeah, we look forward to seeing you there.
Well, and that's reminded me of one other thing. You know, we've tried to make the hotel arrangements as affordable as possible, but if it's in your budget, stay at the hotel where the conference is happening. It just makes it so much easier to engage with everything that's going on, and you won't miss out on anything.
Yeah, that's one thing that's also helpful. If you don't have to drive, you know, every night and go back to your hotel room that's 2 miles away or outside the city somewhere, if you can stay at the hotel, you just bump into so many people. You know, Chris and I will be hanging around. Other people will be hanging around, a lot of the speakers and industry folks. And just you're right downtown in Nashville, where you're walking distance to everything. We try to keep everything really close to the hub as possible. So it's either a short walk or a quick Uber or Lyft ride to an event. So it just makes it easy, and you don't have to deal with parking either, because that's a pain. So yeah, it's going to be a great time. Lots of fun. Looking forward to it. And if you need tickets, DIYMusicianCon.com or DIYMusicianCon.com/Europe for the European conference. If you want to call our listener line and weigh in on a topic or have a question, you can do so. Our number is 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com, or just go to cdbabypodcast.com and leave some comments in the show notes. Really want to hear what people think about the whole phone situation. Is it getting out of control? Have you done anything at your shows to get people to put their phone down? Has it worked? Has it just made your fans mad at you? I'd like to hear about it. Plus, if you just have questions in general or want to weigh in on anything we talked about in this episode or previous episodes, please do so. That's my favorite thing about doing this podcast, is hearing from the artist community what you guys are thinking and experiencing out there on the road. And if you have a tip or trick, that Facebook hack that we got today was great. That kind of stuff is, we learned from it as well. So encourage you to weigh in and call or email or weigh in on the comments.
And in your fascist attempt to control everyone's phone usage during your concert, you might also be shooting yourself in the foot, because that's also how other people might discover you. Some Instagram picture or some video on Facebook of their friend at your show.
That's true. And I forgot to mention that Jack White, what he does is he emails out, or he does something, posts them somewhere, a bunch of photos and video from the show that people can post to their Instagram and Facebook afterwards.
Oh.
So he does supply them with the content. So that becomes an even bigger challenge for an independent artist. Like, you're not going to have a photographer and videographer being able to, you know, take a bunch of photos and have them posted online before the night is done. But if you do have somebody in-house at the show that can do that, that might be something you can tell the audience. But, you know, that's just another thing to manage that takes money and time. And most of us as artists don't have the money or the time because we're so busy.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was one thing I forgot to mention. He does that, which, you know, I was glad to see because he at least is acknowledging the value of all those people posting. He just wants that. He's a purist. He just wants that original relationship that the artist used to have with the fans.
I don't blame him.
I think that's going to do it for this episode. We're just kind of going to stop there.
Yeah. Well, I have one more.
Unless you have
I just have one more plug for Nashville. Is that if you come to our conference, you can go to Jack White's little fantasy land of a music store / recording studio / venue / curio shop. It's amazing. So you should come to our conference.
And with all the Jack White talk we've had today, I did try to get him as a keynote last year and this year. Last year, they kind of let us on for a long time thinking that he might be able to do it. This year, he's busy.
Ah.
So, no Jack White, but you can go see his shop, and it is worth the trip. All right. Well, Chris, that's going to do it. We'll catch everyone next time. See ya.
See ya.
Been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.